I like reading stairs.
But I can never imagine you being a problem, but you're claiming it by your sticker.
Taylor Swift song.
Oh, that's Taylor Swift? Oh. All
right.
It's a quote from one of her songs.
All right, I got it. And my dog is into the whole Taylor Swift thing.
I don't get it, but that's okay. Alrighty, so let's see what we got. Oh no, another perfect attendance, perfect person is here. Man. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Awful. There's gonna be a lot of people who fail because of attendance. That's gonna be great. You all know we have to report attendance, right? That was something they brought in this year. Well, the faculty, we have to report the attendance. So if you have awful attendance and you get an F, college is going to know why.
So you might want to tell your friends who are not showing up anymore, get their butts to class. All right. So we were talking about the Protestant Reformation. The origins. And the origins of the Protestant Reformation come from the conciliarist movement, come from the reaction to the corruption that was going on in the church, going back to the period when it was in the Babylonian captivity, Avignon. When they're focusing on just making money. They're not caring for the souls of the people. And what is the whole purpose of the church? But to help the people. So people started saying, what does the Bible say? Of course, the modern expression of that is those little stickers that you see every now and then. What would Jesus say? It's the same basic idea. Do you think Jesus would have been pleased with the popes living larger than emperors? Having more wealth, having gold everywhere, eating so much food that all they're doing is getting big fat bellies, being corrupt, manipulating people, taking advantage of the poor and the illiterate? No. Nowhere in the Bible does it say that could happen. But did the people know? They did not. Because the Bible, up to Erasmus, was in Latin. And who held the monopoly on the written language of Latin?
Scholars.
Who were all mostly part of?
Nope.
The church. They held the truth. And these conciliarists felt that's the reason why the church was falling off the rails. But how did the conciliarists turn out? Were they successful in bringing about change? Wycliffe alone is an example just to look at. They dug up his body 30 years later, chopped it up in little bits, and burned it and threw his ashes in the river. I mean, come on now. Jan Hus. Oh yeah, we'll listen to you. Oh, nope, psych. Burning at the stake. The church did not tolerate questions, differing opinions. That all changed because of one man. Way back when, 507 years ago tomorrow, according to legend, an Augustinian monk, who also was a theology professor, went to the cathedral in Wittenberg, in Saxony, one of the German kingdoms, and nailed the document to the doors. This, of course, was none other than Martin Luther. Martin Luther being a scholar, was able to do something that few people on earth at the time could do. He could read the words of the conciliarists. Now, here's the greatest irony. If you would have gotten caught with a copy of one of Wycliffe's books, or Marsiglio's books, or Huss's books, you would have been labeled as a heretic, you would have been excommunicated, and you would have burned at the stake. The church did round up copies, burn them. But you know what the church also did? Any book that they burned, they archived. So that way it could be studied to understand the heresy. Well, the problem is this meant there were copies in all of the church's vaults that allowed for scholars to get access to. And you know, lo and behold, Luther reads these books. He read Marsiglio, he read Wycliffe, he read Huss. And he also read Textus Receptus, Erasmus. And you know something? He had questions. Because that's what scholars do. They read, they think, and then they question. So when Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of the cathedral, he wasn't looking to burn the church down. He wanted to have a disputation. Does anyone know what a disputation is?
Conversation.
Conversation that involves a dialogue. Where people question one another. To try to learn communally. Luther reads the words of the conciliarists and like, wait, this was like 80 years ago. And look at what these people were saying. That the church should base itself on scripture. That the Pope is not a god. God is God. Should not the Pope and the cardinals and the bishops all be bound by the rules of the game? Now here's the catch. He didn't say anything new. For the scholars in the church that were aware of the conciliarist movement, he didn't come up with any new ideas. He was reiterating what was said before. But his timing was perfect. He took advantage of what was going on, and he presented a simple message that people could understand. So, side note. I have been told that I am wicked smart. I've always done well academically when I applied myself. I got 1400 on the SATs when I took it at the time when the highest was like 1500. I applied. I could have gone to any university that I wanted to. I was poor though, so I ended up going to UMass. And since I graduated, I have a bachelor's degree. I have two master's degrees. I went to law school and I got a law degree. And when I took the bar exam, I didn't even study for it. Passed it on the first try. I could sit back and I could hold myself as an esteemed member of the collegia, and I could use big words and talk all the time and sound like a stuffed head. But I choose not to, because I like talking to people. What use is me talking at the capacity that I could talk if you don't understand what I say? Well, if you read Wycliffe, if you read Huss, you read Marsiglio, they are speaking at levels equivalent of people needing to interpret what they're saying as having definitely master's degrees, if not PhDs. It's not words for the common people. Guess what Luther does? He writes in a way that anybody who reads it can understand. And how does he get there? Well, he didn't just have an epiphany. No. It took him a long series of events to end up in front of the cathedral in 1517. And it began when he was a young man. His dad wanted Luther to become a lawyer, but Luther believed in the divinity of Christ. He believed in his faith. So he joined the church out of his desire and his love of his faith, or his desire to learn more. He was a disciple of the church until, on the inside, he started seeing things. So, try to give you a good, goofy example. If I say Captain Insano, you know the reference? Talking about? Who's Captain Insano?
He's a wrestler.
He's a wrestler. From what movie?
Waterboy.
What?
Waterboy.
Waterboy. Alright. You never saw the Waterboy?
I don't know what that is.
Oh. Alright, well, so then that one won't work. Well, actually, I'll tell the story anyways. So, the Waterboy, played by Adam Sandler, hero worshipped a wrestler. He had posters all over his room. He had cutouts. He idolized the wrestler. Until the one day he called up the wrestler on a wrestling show. And Captain Insano thought he was talking to like an 8-year-old kid. Because Adam Sandler's character, the water boy, called up and basically asked, "Do you need a water boy?" And he's like, "Oh, this is a cute little kid." And like he was like 29 years old. At which time Captain Insano on TV just started bursting out laughing to the point where he started crying, making fun of him. Which broke his soul. If you have a hero that you worship, and then you get to meet them, and they shit on you, you are shattered. That's what happened to Luther. He idolized the church. He thought it was perfection until he got inside. And he started seeing what was going on with his own eyes. The most significant event along this path happened in 1511. He is chosen by the rector in the monastery that he was studying in to take the monastery's financial reports to Rome. He would have had opportunity potentially to have audience with the Pope himself. So he and another monk start traveling from northern Germany down to Rome. Now, of course, they travel by foot. As they go from parish to parish and monastery to monastery. Of course, the church would open up their doors to the monks and give them a place to sleep and food to eat. But Luther noticed something as he started getting closer and closer to Italy. The monks were less interested in talking about faith and scripture and the Bible, and they were more focused on financial concerns, making money. And it only got worse when he got into Italy. So much so, at one of the last monasteries he stayed at before he got within the city proper, he tried talking to one of his fellow monks about a very simple passage in the Bible, and the monk had no idea what he was talking about. And Luther was like, "Wait, you're a monk and you're studying the Bible like I am and you don't even know what the Bible was in the Bible?" He was perplexed. Then he gets into Rome and it's beyond his imagination. He had heard since the time he was a little boy about Rome being God's shining city on the hill, that it was so perfect in design that if you walk, it would be as if you're walking in heaven itself. But when he arrives, he realizes that Rome is nothing but a den of iniquity. It's filled with whorehouses. There are homeless people everywhere, starving, begging. There is filth and disgust and refuge all around the city. And he is horrified. Because most of the whorehouses and bars and brothels, they were all run by cardinals and bishops. He also was disgusted by how many little vendor carts there were selling relics, like bones of supposed saints and vials of Jesus' blood. But most troubling was how many chunks of the true cross that was for sale. In a letter to one of his colleagues, he famously said something along the lines of that if I had enough money, I could have purchased so many pieces of the true cross that I could have built the world's mightiest fleet. Bones of saints look like chicken bones or dog bones. Vials of blood before refrigeration. You think there's going to be blood that's going to last from Jesus for 1,500 years? He's like, what the hell is going on? But the church is selling. And desperate people trying to save their souls are buying. He sees priests drunk. He sees priests fornicating with whores. He sees priests that when a beggar comes up and asks for a blessing, the priest holds out a cup and says, how much are you going to give me? Horrified. Then he had an epiphany. In Rome, near where the modern Vatican sits, there was a large marble staircase that was said to come from the house of Pontius Pilate himself. Now, if you had enough money, you could pay for the privilege of climbing the stairs on your knees. And if you said the right set of prayers and you got to the top, you would win for yourself an indulgence equal to 1,000 years of penance. While Luther believed, as bad as everything was, this had to be true because it was certified by the Pope himself. Well, he gets down on his knees and he starts saying the prayers, step after step after step. He gets about halfway up and he hears a voice. And this voice says to him, the just shall live by faith. The just shall live by faith. He stops. He thinks. He ponders. His eyesight blurs. He gets up. He walks down the stairs. And he continues to walk all the way back to Saxony. Never delivering the report, never meeting with the Pope. When he returned, he went insane. So much so, he was actually locked up in an insane asylum. Because that's what you used to do with crazy people. You would lock them up and put them away so they didn't harm the public. Well, he turned himself over. And he spent 2 to 3 years in this insane asylum. freaking out until the point when he finally started collecting his thoughts and regaining control of his emotions. He would soon resume a new life. He left the monastery and he would get a job teaching at the University of Wittenberg as a theology professor, because he wanted to learn more. He realized the only way he can settle what he saw is to learn more. And it was there in Wittenberg, while he was teaching, that he stumbled upon another thing that would set him over the edge. He learned about the sale of indulgences. Now, we've talked about indulgences a couple of times. What's an indulgence? Whoa, what do you got? A pardon for a sin. Given by whom? The Pope. Okay. If you recall, the Pope claimed, particularly during the Babylonian captivity, that the Pope had the ability to tap the surplus grace that has been generated by all of the sacrifices of all of the saints and the martyrs. And the Pope could somehow take some of that grace, anoint a piece of paper, and give it to you. And that will help you maybe not get out of punishment, but it will stop you from going to hell, and instead you'd go to purgatory, where eventually you may be able to get up to heaven. Well, since 1510, Pope Leo X had hired a whole bunch of peddlers, salesmen, who spread out across Europe selling indulgences. Because the Pope was trying to raise money to rebuild St. Peter's Basilica. The original basilica had dated back to Roman times, and it was on the verge of complete collapse. According to Catholic tradition, it was built on the site where St. Peter was crucified upside down. So, if you ever have the ability to look at pictures of St. Peter's Basilica, it's one of those buildings that has in it the chapels that were painted by all of the great Renaissance painters. You can't even quantify how much it would cost to build today. But the Pope is sending these people out selling. One of the most successful of all of the peddlers was a man by the name of John Tetzel. And what made him successful was his presentation. See, he had a box, and you can see it in the image. He had a box that he would put on a table. And he would tell people in his sales pitch, and I quote, "As soon as the gold in the basin rings, right then, the soul to heaven springs." Under the concept of indulgences, you get the piece of paper, you can give it to somebody or yourself, and again, they'll have their punishment reduced. Well, Tetzel's going around saying, no. The moment you put the coin in, and if you hear a ring, that person's soul is going to get out of wherever they are instantly and go right up to heaven. At a time when people, the vast majority of people, 95% were illiterate, at a time when the only thing that they worried about morning, noon, and night was their eternal soul, hearing somebody, a representative of the church, tell you this, you did not doubt. You would give any amount of money to save your mother from hell, to save your dead child. By the way, if a child died before becoming an adult, it was said they died because their soul was sinful. So they went to hell. Imagine having a newborn child that dies in pure innocence. You want to do anything to save it. Or a loved one. Or a friend. You'd pay any amount of money. There were people who could not afford food that were giving whatever they had to be able to buy this scrap of piece of paper. Well, on the day that Tetzel came in, Luther, as he was common to do, made his way through the center of town. And there was a woman, a homeless woman, who had a newborn that he was giving charity to. So he gave her a coin and instructed her, as he did every day, make sure you go get some milk for your baby. To which, as she, oh, God bless you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Luther goes around, finishes his errands, and starts coming back. And lo and behold, what does he see the woman doing? Puts the coin in the box. Luther freaks out. Not at her, at Tetzel. He goes over and confronts him. Starts yelling at him, saying, where in Scripture does it say you can buy forgiveness of sin? Tetzel fired back. I am all here on His Holiness's orders, and to question His Holiness is heresy. Back and forth, arguing, arguing. But at some point, one of the guys bumped into another, hits the table, and the box goes over, bam, breaks open. And what do they see on the inside? This little ramp that comes down from the slot. So if you look in, all you can see is dark. And in the corner, before the coin hits the bottom, is a bell. So that way, every single coin that drops in hits the bell. It was a Ponzi scheme. Luther held up the box and yelled to the crowd, see what your church represents. See what His Holiness represents. Took up the money and threw it back into the crowd. At that point, he had enough. He went back to his house and he started writing the 95 Theses. And if you have a chance to read the excerpt that is in the reader, not that any of you have ever done any of the extra credit, but it's in the reader, and you can Google it. Brain fart. All he does is blends the message of all of the conciliarists. As I said before, he didn't come up with any new ideas. These were points that had been out there for 80, 90, 100, 200 years. But the core is Scripture. When's November 8th?
It's next week.
November 8th. Oh, Friday. Northfield. Where the hell is Northfield? Do you know where Northfield, Massachusetts is? Thanks. A lot of help here, Michelle. Appreciate that. North.
It's like near Vermont.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Ew. Ooh, it's up near Satan's Kingdom Wildlife. Do I have anything next Friday? I should wait on this. All right, I can't work and do this at the same time. All right. So, Luther buttresses the 95 Theses on Scripture. Romans, well, Book of the First Romans, chapter 16, verses 16 and 17. In it, this verse describes justification by faith. And it reads, and I quote, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes. First to the Jew, then to the Gentile. For in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. A righteousness that is by faith, from first to last. Just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith. Luther figured it all out in one epiphany. You don't need a global institution that bases its existence by manipulating people into getting donations. You don't need hundreds of bishops and cardinals that live like nobles in palaces. You don't need that. You want to get to heaven? You only need one thing. F-A-I-T-H. If you believe in the existence of God and that Jesus, his son, came down to earth as man, walked among us, and then sacrificed himself by dying on the cross for us, do you need anything else? Do you need anything else? Because if you believe in Jesus, you're going to live by Jesus' words. And what is Jesus' words? Well, it tells you what not to do. The thou shalls and the thou shall nots. And if you do all the thou shalls, don't live in sin, guess what? You're going up. This is the core message of the 95 Theses. Essentially, if you sin, you can't get out of it. No one can grant you salvation. Especially not the Pope. By selling you scraps of paper. No. The only thing that can save you is yourself by living properly. In the 95 Theses, he also declares that there is no need for indulgences if you're a true Christian. But for those who not, no. There is no freedom from penalty. You'll pay the price in the afterlife. But the choice is yours. This was no PhD dissertation. This was not a rambling focus that is word salad, where you just put words in there just to hear yourself talk without actually saying anything. No. This was simple. You don't want to go to hell, then believe. And if you believe, you will not go to hell. Like I said before, making a message simple so everyone can understand. There you go. Oh, and by the way, his 95 Theses were one of the first documents that were mass produced. Because by the time he wrote this book, Gutenberg did not put a patent on his printing press, and there were shops in almost every major city. So copies were being made and distributed. In fact, by the time he died, there were over 700,000 copies of his works in circulation. He also synthesized the conciliarist message. The church is corrupt. nor the church live by Scripture. Believe. So, no matter what you liked or didn't like about the church, here's your fix. And what he did inconsequentially was essentially set people's sights on the church. And by the way, he was willing to die for it. How many of you have principles which you believe in that you'd be willing to die for? He wasn't afraid, because as he said over and over again, the only thing I fear is eternal damnation. And I will not live by false messages. Luther challenged the church, so what did the church do? They excommunicated him. And soon the church started excommunicating anyone who agreed with Luther's positions. And he continued to add to his argument. He argued, for example, look at the world as it is. Is this as good as it gets? Or can we do better? He pushed progressivism. You know, if you don't like the way things are, don't keep doing it over and again. Try to fix it. He rejects all good works, all of the things that the church says you have to do. No amount of reading the rosaries or saying prayers or doing All Fathers and Hail Marys, none of that is going to make up if you murder somebody, if you rape, if you steal, if you lie. But if you live by Scripture, you'll never do that. He also would eventually argue that you don't even need priests. What do you need priests for? You should read the Bible for yourself. He encouraged literacy. Because he argued every man or woman could be their own priest. He also denied the infallibility of the popes. He was one of the first people to argue that a pope is just a man. The only one who is perfect is God. So because the Pope is a man, he can be wrong. And what's going to happen to your soul if you follow someone who is wrong? Scripture. This would begin a nearly 30-year campaign of him essentially formulating what would become a counter-movement to the Catholic Church, shattering the universality that the Church had enjoyed in Europe for hundreds of years. Everyone in Europe was Catholic, no more. After he was excommunicated, he went out and got married. He married a nun, Catherine von Bora. And had not one, not two, but six children. Legitimate children born in wedlock. He also would create his own church, which would become known as the Lutheran Church. And he wrote, and he wrote, and he wrote. Including, he took Textus Receptus, looked at Erasmus's Greek translation, and took that Greek and translated it into German. So Luther codified the questions that Erasmus had found. And by the way, every Protestant Bible since is based on Erasmus's book, not the Vulgate, not the Latin Bible. And he wrote psalms and sermons and pamphlets. Well over 200 in his lifetime. But as Luther got older, he became cantankerous. He became cranky. Because he was angry at not everybody realizing the truth of what he was saying. So what did he start doing? He started attacking. Not just the people that were in the church, but anyone who disagreed with them. Which kind of exposed the weakness of his argument. He attacked Catholics for not leaving the church. He attacked Jews for not accepting the divinity of Christ. And by the way, Luther's attacks on Jews would be recognized by the National Socialist German Workers' Party, which in German gets abbreviated to Nazi. He also attacked other Protestant churches for getting it wrong, because only he got it right. But in the end, he took a sledgehammer and put it through a church wall, and the church started to crumble. Questions?
How did he go 30 years without, like, the church basically pointing him down?
What?
How did he go 30 years without the church, like, pointing him down?
I got it. It's coming. So to answer your question literally, how did he do it? How did he do it? Well, on one hand, he became wicked popular because his message was simple. And it didn't matter if you were a peasant or if you were a noble. His message was appealing to all. Why? Because he gave something to everyone, which was truly revolutionary. First and foremost, as I said, he didn't say anything new. Anyone who had two eyes in their head knew at the time the church was corrupt. So it wasn't like he was saying something that was, you know, completely out of nowhere. He also allowed the nobles to play politics. Because if any noble converted to Protestantism, they could seize the church lands and sell them and make money. They also could stop all the tithing, all of the money, the 30% or so, that left each kingdom that went to Rome. Could stop that as well. But in terms of ideas, it was simple. All he was doing was preaching Jesus' original intent. Be a good person, love thy neighbor. Be decent, be kind, be charitable. Who can't do that? And, oh, she left. And what about the people who opposed him? Well, they were weak too, because as I said before, his timing was perfect. Now, he could have been destroyed by one of two forces. The temporal, the sword, or the spiritual, the church. As for the temporal, the emperor of Germany was Charles V. The problem was, first off, Charles was young. In 1516, at the age of 16, he became the King of Spain because he was the grandson of Ferdinand and Isabella. Well, when his father, Maximilian, died, who was the King of Austria and the Holy Roman Emperor in 1519, he also became those positions. giving birth to what is known as the Habsburg dynasty. The king of Spain, at the time of Columbus and the conquest of the Aztec and the Inca and all of the new world wealth, plus control of the central part of Europe. At the age of 19, he was in charge of 2,000 nobles, 66 city-states, 100 imperial courts, 30 princes, 70 bishoprics. And his empire was the largest empire on earth at the time. Most of you guys in here are probably 18, 19, 20. If you had all of that to deal with, do you really think you were paying attention to what one theology professor was saying? Now, by the way, FYI, he actually did demand Luther come before him at an imperial court at Worms. And he engaged in a conversation with him. But at the end of the day, the emperor didn't hear anything overly shocking that justified him being killed by the state. So he let him go. Well, when he was released, he returned to Saxony, where the Prince of Saxony gave him sanctuary and stopped any efforts by the church to send assassins to get him. And as for the church, well, what could the church do? The church itself was divided on this stuff. Because all Luther was saying was the truth, what everybody knew. The most shocking thing is that even though he was excommunicated, the church was paralyzed because they were terrified about another schism. So instead of acting to try to stop him, they did nothing. And thus he continued to write. And his works were copied, and they spread more and more and more. So the last thought of the day is very simple. If and when you are all fortunate enough to own a house, if you're sitting in your room and you see a drip of water coming through the ceiling, don't wait. Act on it. Because if you put it off and put it off and put it off, eventually a huge chunk of your roof is going to cave in. That's ultimately what happened. Questions? All right. Last thought of the day. Paper, paper, paper. Due date's coming up. So we'll see y'all on Friday.